Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Jones! Bowden! He's got it! England have won the World Cup by the barest of margins!
Stokes flashes it away through the covers for four, and England have won the match!
Hello, welcome to the Analyst Inside Cricket, the 8th of April. Monday the 8th of April, we've had a week of, well, a few days anyway, of the county championship, but not much to show for it really, apart from some very harassed looking ground staff around the place. Only one positive result, two abandonments, one that is virtually an abandonment because the ground staff were worried about the covers blowing away and then blowing with it, I guess. So a realistic problem there up at Old Trafford. But in the meantime, some quite interesting cricket, Simon, with a triple century at Lord's, the highest ever score by an individual batsman at Lord's, and a double, and also a hat-trick at the Essex game. So some good stuff to talk about. We're not going to necessarily focus too much on the individual matches because we have an interesting interview coming up today with Ben Bloom, a former sports writer with The Telegraph, now freelance, who's written a really interesting book about the future of county cricket. So we'll get into that in a bit. But what was your take over those first 4 days of the county season, Simon?
Oh, welcome to the new season, Jos. I mean, the weather was shocking, wasn't it, generally speaking? I mean, a couple of games completely rained out. There were some great performances. Also, as well, what about that pitch at Lord's being reported to Lord's? It was so flat, wasn't it? I mean, you can't bat in early April. Goodness me, we had a double century and a triple century. In fact, the highest score ever recorded in a first-class match at Lord's by Sam Northeast. Yeah, and another Sam, 10 for 73 for Essex, the only winners. We also should talk about the situation at Sussex, and it actually relates to the interview we've got coming up with Ben, really, don't we, about the financial future of the game, because in that match at Hove, Sussex were pushing for victory on the final day. They had Northants 9 down. The light was deteriorating. And Sussex have made a decision for financial reasons, or that's one of the reasons, not to use floodlights this season. Cost them something like £150 an hour or something. And they didn't think, you know, the number of overs they use it for or get, and the benefit wouldn't be worth it. Well, the Northants were 9 down. If they'd had them this evening, they might have stayed on. They might have been able to win the game. I mean, it shows, doesn't it? It's some counties, yeah, struggling a bit financially. You know, they feel the pinch.
Energy prices cost Sussex victory in 2024. My God. Actually, Ben Bloom, the author we're going to talk to shortly, he actually got into the game largely because of the success of Sussex in the early 2000s when they won the championship a couple of times for the first time in their history, piloted to those titles partly by the introduction of Mushtaq Ahmed, the brilliant leg spinner from Pakistan, as well as many other luminaries as well. Go back to Lord's and two totals of over 600 amazing on the first week of the season. So people saying you shouldn't be playing cricket in early April because it's a seamer's paradise. I suppose maybe one point there is they weren't particularly enjoying bowling with a kookaburra ball in April because it wasn't doing a lot, was it? And, well, a magnificent pitch for batsmen rolled out at Lord's. Probably should be reported, actually. Too good.
Yeah, or too flat or whatever. I mean, you know, it happens, doesn't it? In Test cricket, all the pitches are reviewed, and if it's too flat, it's seen as a poor pitch. You know, it's happened not just overseas, but it's also happened in this country as well. There was a Test pitch at Trent Bridge, I think around about 2014, England-India, where that was just so flat and dead. And I think that didn't get a very good mark as well. But, yeah, I mean, remarkable scores, really, for this time of year. Other places, no play. Here's something else I was thinking about. It's because I was watching the Northamptonshire game against Sussex on their stream and thinking Northamptonshire were sort of probably going to lose, but you know, got saved by the bad light and the weather closing in. They were probably going to lose, but they get 13 points from that game. Okay, because they got some first innings runs and they got some wickets. So they got 13 points, 8 for a draw, and what was it, 5 bonus points. Gloucestershire and Derbyshire and Hampshire and Durham, who didn't get onto the field at all, didn't get the chance to get any points, only get 8. And so you get one team who were about to lose, probably, get 13 points, and one team who had no chance at all to play any cricket, only get 8 points. Anyway, it just seems a bit unfair. I wonder whether the point system should reflect the fact that you don't play, whether, you know, if there are, you know, washouts, complete washouts, whether you actually get more than 8 points, because you don't have a chance to get any bonus points. Of course, you could risk losing by playing, but you don't get a chance to get any points. Is that fair?
This is an early season.
Is life
bleat.
Fair?
It's an early season bleat about Gloucestershire, this is. Sort of,
well, it's a second season in a row.
Relegation prospects. Not that they can be relegated, because you can't get relegated from the bottom of the second division. Oh, dear.
Listen, second season in a row, they've had their first game completely washed out. Last year it was at Worcester. This year is at Derby. Anyway, it's the vagaries of the weather, isn't it? I mean, there was play some places and no play elsewhere. So it's just what happens. The other thing as well, Yoz, is people saying, well, should we start in early April? Should we play into October? I've heard that comment in the last few days with sort of the bleak weather. I mean, it hasn't been that cold, has it? It's been colder at this time of year for cricket. But, you know, it's the high wind. We had all these storms over the weekend, high wind, rain, whatever, lots of rain in the lead up to it. Should we play early October? You know, a couple of extra weeks at the back end of October. Well, people are moaning about playing in September, aren't they? Saying, oh, you can't play in September. That's not great for spinners and this, that and the other. The only problem with playing in October is the light, isn't it? The light goes much quicker. So I think there's more light this time of year.
Yeah, that's right.
Than there is in October.
And there's more chance of better weather at this time of year, actually. Funnily enough, one of my weddings, no irony intended there, was...
Just to remind us how many of you had?
was on the 31st of March, about 94 or something like that. And it was actually
memorable
a beautiful day.
Then.
It was a beautiful day, and we played football outside. I got married, of course, predictably, at a cricket club, and we played football in the afternoon with all our sort of, you know, finery on, just for a bit of a laugh, and it was a beautiful day. So you can get lovely weather in early April. I mean, I suppose the ultimate solution for English cricket, and this is something that we didn't talk about in the interview with Ben Bloom, but I mean, it's the overriding issue. We've got to have covered stadiums, haven't we? Because it's the only way. We've got too many matches to try and pack into 5 months, of which the first 2 or 3 weeks and the last 2 or 3 weeks have got suspect weather and, in the case of September, dodgy light. So it's covered stadiums or nothing, isn't it? And actually, people might say, well, what a ridiculous idea. But they've got two in Australia that work perfectly well. And I know they're used for other sports as well, like Aussie rules. But they actually work pretty well, those covered stadiums in Australia. So it's always going to be a cost issue. And when you've got a county like Sussex who are arguing and, you know, debating whether they can put the lights on or not for 150 quid an hour, I guess the covered stadium idea is a bit of a pipe dream. But maybe in the future, it's a solution.
Well, it's something we always talk about. Whenever we go to a test match day and it rains all day and there's no play, we all say, what on earth are we doing playing cricket in this country? We should have a covered stadium. And they do have that one in Melbourne, don't they? And the great thing about it is, you know there's going to be play. If there's a T20 match, Big Bash match in the evening, you know there is going to be play. And sometimes, when it's lovely weather in Melbourne, they open the roof as well, so that, you know, it's not always undercover. Sometimes
that's right.
You can see the blue sky above as well.
Now, I was just trying to think, just quickly on to recap that Middlesex game, Middlesex against Glamorgan, 600 plays 600. I was trying to think, had I ever fielded for a day at Lords? Which just shows how the game has changed, doesn't it? Because in the days of 3-day and to at the start of 4-day cricket, you know, teams didn't bat all day, definitely. And in the case of the Middlesex side that I played in, I can only remember conceding 400 once. And that was to Worcester when Graham Hick was in his pomp. And actually, it was a memorable day because we were still bowling, obviously, at the end of the day. And I was bowling the last over of the day, probably about my 32nd of the day or something, and the ball was hit by Steve Rhodes, the former Worcestershire wicketkeeper, through the mid-wicket region, and Mark Ramprakash, a young 17-year-old Mark Ramprakash, was fielding at mid-wicket, and it was, we were pretty tired at the end of the day. He rather ambled after the ball. The captain that day was Paul Downton, because Mike Gatting was in the test match. And Paul Downton, very unusually, shouted at Mark Ramprakash to get after the ball. Because Paul Downton never raised his voice. You know, he'd invite the bailiffs in for tea. You know, he's that sort of polite guy. He used to say when it was time to have a blow, because you hadn't bowled very well, you bowled rubbish. You know, he'd just say, have a little blow, maybe come back later when you just bowled four overs for 30. You know, so he was a very polite man. And he actually did shout at Mark Ramprakash, come on, Ramps, get after it. And the scene in the dressing room afterwards, four balls later, at the end of the day's play, was something I've never seen before. The player in question actually accosted his captain. And, I mean, we had to pull him, we had to drag him off. You know, Mark won't remember that incident with much kind of pleasure, but he just lost it that day. And that's the only time I think I remember ever fielding for a whole day. And luckily, it was never repeated.
What, because of Nurse Frey, did they? Because he was like in the field for a whole day and everyone got a bit agitated.
And tired, you know, fatigue and, you know, sort of irritation that we hadn't been able to bowl them out. And it was fractious in the pavilion afterwards, in the dressing room. It really was. It was quite an uncomfortable experience. These days, obviously, players are much better at dealing with it, aren't they?
Well, they have to deal with it, don't they? 4-day cricket, flat pitches. I mean, what about that score from Glamorgan? I mean, admittedly, Middlesex bowlers were only out there, in inverted commas, for 139 overs. Middlesex batted for 211 overs to make their 655. But, I mean, at least, I suppose you could at least say Glamorgan to some extent were taking wickets, whereas Middlesex took 3 wickets, didn't they, in those 139 overs. On the second, they didn't take a single wicket. It was 370 for 3 at the close. But I think, well, players are just more used to it now. I mean, just remind everyone, or just tell people who don't know why you wouldn't have fielded for a whole day very often. It was, of course, because you had 3-day matches for the most part, and teams would pull out before the close of play, wouldn't they? If you had a good batting day, you would nip out before the close. Sometimes there was a limit of 100 overs, you know, different rules and different times. You would nip out before and try to take a couple of wickets before the close of play.
You would, and it was a horrible experience, because you quite often field for the first, you know, 75, 80 overs, and then, you know, bowl your heart out. They declared at 300 for 7, with 7 overs to go, and then you, the person who just bowled 24 overs of your best stuff, had to go and get the pads on, get ready for being night watchman, and usually get sent out there as well. So, yeah, it was a pretty uncomfortable experience.
I presume you're getting paid there, Yoz, were you? You were getting paid to bowl and then go
really?
Out and bat, were you?
I didn't have much left at the end of the day, at the end of the week, really. I mean, I think the most I ever got paid was about 20 grand a year. So, you know. And that was a whole year, not just a season. So
yeah, but you are talking 60,
dark
70
ages,
years ago.
Dark ages, true. Yeah, that's right. Where it was the old pound notes, wasn't it? Played in readies kind of thing. Suitcase full of cash at the end of the week. Thank you very much. P45 in September. Talking of which, we should get to our interview today with Ben Bloom, who was actually prompted to write this book by some other Telegraph colleagues. It's called Batting for Time, The Fight to Keep English Cricket Alive. Ben Bloom, as I said, was a Telegraph sports writer for a long time, covered a lot of athletics, football, rugby, cricket, and other sports. And now is freelance, writes for The Guardian, writes for The Times, writes for various other organisations as well. And he's obviously always been passionate about cricket at heart. And so this book is about, he's done a lot of interviews with a lot of county people up and down the country over the last year and a half to try and understand and unravel what are the issues in county cricket and maybe how can they be solved. So here is Ben Bloom. And the first question I asked him was, why has he written this book?
I wrote it. The first seed for the idea came from a piece that Nick Holt wrote in The Telegraph, which came after the ECB High Performance Review, or the Strauss Review, as it's better known. And then that created something of a members' uprising. And Nick wrote a piece in The Telegraph. It was some time towards the end of 2022. And it talked about the civil war in county cricket. And I thought it was a brilliant piece. And I thought there was so much more to delve into. Cricket has always been a passion of mine. It's been a profession of mine, writing about it. I love the domestic game. And it just seems like with every year that goes by, things become more uncertain. And with the spread of franchise leagues in 2023, with various lucrative leagues launching around the world, it seemed like a real opportune time to properly delve into the subject and see, canvas as many opinions as I possibly could and see what people thought about the state of the game and where things might go. And I think it'll be really interesting to see in 5 or 10 years, have a look at the book and see what's happened.
So you say you always loved cricket. What's your first cricketing memory? Where do you go back to?
Familiar story, I imagine, to lots of people. My dad played, not to any decent level, just friendly local Sunday league, not even Sunday league, Sunday amateur pub type cricket. So going along with him, really, and watching from the boundary, through him and through his dad. So 3 generations, we've been Sussex supporters. So watching Sussex, although I've always lived in London, so travelling down to Hove a few times a year. So watching Sussex, watching England play, watching my dad play, and then me playing myself.
What is the process, or what was the process of writing this? One of the stats you mention is that there are 69,000 fully paid up members of the 15 counties that are not privately owned. So, you know, there's a sort of nucleus of people there. It feels like you've spoken to quite a lot of them.
Yeah, I wanted to canvass as many views as I possibly could. So from the top, Richard Gould at the ECB, and I spoke to various other people at the ECB as well who have different remits. Then going down a notch to county chief execs and chairman, directors of cricket, then speaking to the players, speaking to player agents, and then I wanted to get the other side as well, so members, and some of them are affiliated with different member organisations, official member organisations, local and or national, and then some are just those county diehards that have been members for 50, 60 years and have had the same seat at whatever ground that whole time and live and breathe the domestic game. And so I thought, if I can speak to as many people as I possibly can, I'm going to get every opinion. And I think I managed fairly well. There's always people that I could and should have pursued harder, but I've got a decent cross-section of views in there.
Mm. And you have actually gone with quite a few different age ranges as well, or a decent age range. So you've talked to people in their 20s and right up to, you know, 70s and so on, 80s, and people who've been following their county for 50 years, which is interesting. Do you feel from talking to all those people that county cricket has reached a sort of one of many crises, but one that is quite deep rooted and quite sort of more worrying than some in the past?
I think the finances and the spread of franchise leagues make this crisis more severe and more worrying than past crises, because there have been various financial crises over the course of county cricket, which has been in existence for over 100 years, and people have feared the loss of counties, and incredibly 18 counties have survived to the present day. There weren't always 18 first class counties, but no first class county has been lost along the way, and that is not the case in football and rugby and various other sports, who have habitually lost teams. Having spoken to various people, senior people and people that have to crunch the numbers, really, they are the ones saying that they fear not being able to survive in 5 to 10 years without certain changes. Now, some of those proposed changes are private investment, i.e. we need more money or we can't continue. Some of them are potentially structural changes to try and combat the spread of franchise leagues. There are different arguments as to how to combat the threat, but it did feel from speaking to various people that the threat does feel existential now, whereas in the past, perhaps it wasn't quite that severe.
I suppose it's the vexed problem or the perennial problem of professional sport, isn't it? You know, when these sports, I mean, in my era playing county cricket, and Simon Mann often jokes about this, it was largely amateur. I mean, you know, I tell the story of falling asleep at Long Leg because we'd had a late night out sort of thing, and many other examples. Now, because it's so professional and because the IPL and other franchise tournaments have raised the stakes, it becomes something, in the end, it's about the cost of the players, isn't it? And to a lesser extent, I suppose, the cost of the grounds as well. You have to maintain standards in grounds. You have to put floodlights up. You have to, you know, replace seats and make it more comfortable for people to come. But you've got to essentially pay for players who now expect more money. And it's made, say, you know, professional club rugby almost unsustainable. It's put cricket, county cricket, on the brink as well. So, I mean, you know, is the fundamental problem that county cricket doesn't really know what it's for? And in fact, one of your chapters is called "What is the Purpose of County Cricket?" In fact, the last chapter.
Yeah, definitely. The purpose of county cricket totally varies depending on who you ask. Some people argue that those counties that haven't produced England players in the last decade or so don't really deserve to exist because they're not serving a purpose. They're not serving the national team. Other people completely disagree with that and think that results on the field are essentially meaningless. And these are community organisations. They are member owned. So they're owned by the community. They operate for the community. They are very much not a business. And that is a key word that a lot of members use. They're not a business. They are a community organisation. And Derbyshire or Gloucestershire or Leicestershire are just as important as Surrey, Lancashire, Yorkshire, whoever. It doesn't matter how big your stadium is and how many players you produced. They all have an important part to play in the ecosystem. Now, those are two total opposite ends of the spectrum. One says the small ones aren't doing anything, so it doesn't matter if they fall by the wayside. And the other says all 18 are equal. And then there's various different arguments in the middle. Or on that spectrum.
I suppose the problem, in a way, is that it's all very well to say they are a community service, and I totally see that, and I know how important county cricket is to many people, and I run a virtual cricket club which has many county fans as members, and they talk passionately about their county and the matches they're looking forward to. The trouble is you've got to pay for that service, haven't you? You know, it is a community service, but it needs funding to survive. And where is that funding coming from, apart from the ECB, which obviously, you know, subsidises a lot of these counties, if not all of them? I guess, you know, members, and some counties have only got, you know, 1,500 members, say Derbyshire or someone. How do you sustain it with that small number of members who are probably paying 200 quid a year? So there is a kind of a paradox there that's hard to kind of to rectify in a way.
Yeah, exactly. And the issue is, which you touched upon, it was very different in your era. And even more recently, it was very different. 10 years ago, 15 years ago, it was very different. Things weren't as professional, and the way that sport was consumed by the watching public was very different. These days, in 2024, sport has become so much more businesslike. Not just cricket, all sports. And all sports are trying to work out a way to stay sustainable and operate in these changing landscapes. Now, football is football. Football is so big that it can do whatever it wants, really. But every other sport is struggling and trying to work out a way to do that. Now, the issue is that these 18 first-class counties, they've been in existence since the Victorian era. This infrastructure was created over 100 years ago at a time that was so vastly different to 2024. They weren't businesses back then. Well, they may have been officially businesses, but they weren't businesses in the sense that they are in 2024. The financial pressures are so severe now that the people who run the coffers and are in charge of the money matters would argue that they have to operate in a vastly different way to 10, 20, 50, 100 years ago. And the members perhaps don't always appreciate that.
Mm. And which leads us on to the subject of the 100. And your chapter about the 100 is entitled Abomination or Saviour. I mean, my take on it is, just to sort of put one side of the story, is that it has been a sort of salvation, because it's generated a revenue that, I mean, you know, lots of people say, well, why couldn't the T20 Blast have generated the same media revenue? But it wouldn't have done, because it just didn't. It didn't attract broadcasters in the same way as an idea of the 100. And one of the things about the 100, which I think is clever, is that because it's a closed tournament, 8 teams, no promotion and relegation, and it may eventually be 10, it provides a safe space for investors who know that they can invest in a team in the future, and that team won't be relegated. And that's one of the principal problems with the Premier League, isn't it? And probably rugby as well, is that you get relegated, you immediately lose a huge amount of funding, and it's then a struggle from then on. So the in a way, for me, the brilliance of the 100 is that it is, it drew that broadcast revenue, which propped up a number of counties. And secondly, it's got the potential for that private investment, which is what all sports seek and probably can't survive without.
Yeah, I completely agree with you that the private investment, or the impending private investment that we expect to be announced fairly soon, is going to be crucial. I would argue is going to be crucial to propping up the English domestic game as a whole. And so in that sense, the 100 is without doubt a benefit. Now, on the flip side, I think it will have some pretty negative effects on some of the smaller counties, the counties that are not host counties and therefore aren't going to be given a stake in these 100 teams to either keep or sell and therefore make more money for themselves. The gaps are going to get bigger between the haves and the have-nots. The informal, or some element of informal two-tier model, is going to start developing. It might develop to such an extent that it will have to be formalised, in that the bigger counties are sort of kept separate from the smaller counties, because there's not really any point in the equivalent of Manchester City playing Wickham Wanderers or something like that, because they operate on completely different planes. And I can see the 100 and investment in the 100 fast-tracking that divide between the haves and the have-nots. Now, it depends how you look at it. If you look at it for the good of the whole game, you would say that is a benefit to the English game because it will ensure that it's in a solid standing for the long term, as we said, in this landscape that we exist in 2024. But if you look at it from a smaller mind point, i.e. a county member of one of these small counties, they justifiably fear for the existence of their clubs.
And I suppose you can sympathise with those people. I mean, I can think of several people I know who, you know, passionately love their county and will watch every game. You've got a guy, actually, you interviewed who has been watching Derbyshire every ball for 20 years or more. And he was a policeman. So God knows whether he was ever able to get on the beat or anything, given that he was watching Derbyshire home and away. How are they going to cope with, say, a Derbyshire going out of existence?
Well, a lot of that type of person, i.e. the very entrenched long-term county member that I spoke to, either outright suggested or insinuated that they wouldn't really mind if their county was downgraded to national/minor county status, because that whole community element would still be there. I think they don't want their counties to disappear. I think realistically, no county will ever disappear. They might go down to national county level, which would effectively be semi-professional or entirely amateur. They would be a shell of their former selves. Most counties have won the county championship at some time in their existence. So to then be downgraded to amateur or semi-pro status is a huge downward step. But they would still exist. And so these people, the type of people that you mentioned, someone that hasn't missed a day for 20 years, I imagine they're so... they're such diehards that they would continue to watch every single day of their county play. What effect it would have on things like player production and academies and that type of thing is a whole separate, perhaps more concerning issue.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
You make some case studies in the book, and I'm just going to contrast to Durham, who obviously have Tim Bostock as their chief exec, who you've had quite a lot of notoriety quoting him about accusing members of Luddite, being a lot of county members of being Luddites, and he rather regrets. I heard him talking with Michael Atherton and Nasser saying about that, and he sort of rather regretted using that term. But you've got his view on one side, and then you've got Leicester as another case study of a county that are really struggling. I mean, Durham obviously have a lot of, a big hinterland and a big catchment area. Leicester much smaller, hemmed in by other counties. And they've both got different ways of how they sustain their business. Just tell us a little bit about the Durham model against the Leicester model.
Paul Farbrace, down at Sussex, he said a brilliant quote to me. He said that one of the difficulties of trying to get all 18 counties to decide the future of the game is that it's like getting Harrods and your local corner shop to agree on the future. People operate entirely differently, different finances, different parts of the country. It's all totally different. So trying to have some sort of homogenous outlook is impossible. So you've got someone like Durham. Durham are one of the three non-member-owned counties. So Tim Bostock up there is not answerable to his members, which he's very, very happy about. He I should add, he doesn't believe that all members are Luddites. He explains himself very eloquently in the book. But he did also say that he counts himself fortunate not to be answerable to members because he feels like he can operate the club in a more business-like manner, be more objective, and try and modernise, essentially. And the way that he would like to do that is join an expanded 100, so have a 100 team there. Obviously, they've built this international stadium up there, so host international cricket, have various other revenue streams, hotels, conferences, that type of thing, and bring the 100 there and try and compete with, you know, Surrey, Lancashire, those types of big counties. Leicestershire can't do that. And Sean Jarvis, the chief exec there, he knows that they're not going to get a 100 team. They're not going to build a 20,000 seater stadium. They're not going to host big international cricket, although I know they host women's cricket. So he has to look at things differently and try and work out another route to sustainability. And he's come up with this Academy of Cricket idea, which is that he believes that Leicestershire's place in the ecosystem is to provide provide players that potentially wouldn't get a chance at some of the bigger counties a route into English cricket, and players like Stuart Broad and James Taylor and Luke Wright, they're his examples. Rayan Ahmed is the most recent one, leaves Nottinghamshire because he feels like he can get a greater chance at Leicestershire. On the field, he wants to be the Academy of Cricket. He creates these players, and if they then go off to the bigger counties once they've made their name or they're starting to make their name, so be it. Leicestershire have proved their worth. Now, what he also wants to do off the field is harness that Academy of Cricket idea by creating a qualification, a professional qualification, that potential cricket administrators can learn about the business side of cricket. And so Leicestershire would be this county that is creating players on the pitch, but is also nurturing the future administrators of the game off the pitch. And that's how a small county, a county that had finished bottom of the second division, some ridiculous number, I forget the numbers, but it was about half the time of the last decade, how a county like that can show value and provide value to the English game. And I think it's a really smart way of going about things, thinking, well, what can we do that's unique? We're not going to be part of the 100. We're not going to host England in test matches, but what can we do? And Sean Jarvis has come up with these ideas. It remains to be seen whether he's successful in translating it to off the field, but I think he should be commended for trying.
Yeah, I agree. And you use the phrase there, off the field. Do you think actually that fundamentally that's the key to this? Because something I've always felt, you know, county cricket grounds, whether they're Lords or Derbyshire, you know, are big areas of real estate which are only utilised, and we've seen this weekend, you know, with counties rained off, wind off, you know, with wind causing games to be called off, etc. How difficult it is to stage cricket in England. So these stadiums, grounds, whatever you want to call them, are only active for 40, 50 days a year. And out of those 40, 50 days a year, maybe they don't fill the stadiums more than 10 days a year, if you're lucky. So there has to be a way of finding a use for that real estate beyond those 50 days. And, you know, some counties have come up with hotels or, as you say, an academy of cricket. I suppose the problem is, A, is this the solution? But it isn't the solution for a county necessarily like Sussex because they're constrained by the size of their arena.
Yeah, but it, even with economies of scale, it does work. So Surrey, Surrey earn an enormous sum of money. I think they earn something like 26 or 29 million a year, or their income just from their events business. Now, you've got half a dozen counties that their income is around 5 million for all strands of their business. So Surrey are miles off the end of the scale. But then you go down to somewhere like Derbyshire, and their biggest earning day in the 2023 season was when they hosted The Who at a concert at their ground. Now, Derbyshire operate on tiny, tiny budgets compared to Surrey, but hosting The Who was the difference between turning a profit and not turning a profit. And they turned a profit last year. Derbyshire have turned a profit for quite a while. They're very well run, but they operate on a much, much smaller scale. So for them, they don't have all of this real estate. They can't build all of these things that someone like Surrey or Hampshire, like Rod Bransgrove did down in Hampshire. But they can still think up ways of making money. So hosting fireworks nights and inviting The Who to come and perform, that type of thing.
It's sort of creative thinking, isn't it? Trying to find other ways of using your land and without ruining it. Obviously, there are times when, like you mentioned last summer, where the Arctic Monkeys concert at Hampshire then caused Hampshire to be deducted points for a poor pitch after that concert. But I suppose these things happen from time to time. That's a positive note that sounded there, that, you know, counties can survive by finding other ways of using their land. Just one other thing. What about the women's game? You have a chapter on women's cricket. Is that in a way another possible salvation for the game as a whole?
Definitely. I think it's going to be incredibly important in years to come, because it has risen so quickly. Obviously, the women have played cricket for decades, but the prominence that it's been given in such a short period of time, like women's sport across the board, football and rugby, it's growing so much, and it's such a growth area. However, I think it will be part of this divide between the haves and the have-nots, because we're currently going through a bidding process whereby 16 of the 18 counties have put in to try and host one of the new women's county teams. There's going to be 8 of them from next year. So 8 counties are going to have top tier women's teams. And we don't know who those 8 are going to be yet, but we can all have reasonable guesses that it's likely to match the 800 teams. The women's pyramid is going to be closed, so there won't be promotion and relegation. So there won't be a chance for those smaller counties, at least in the first cycle, 4-year cycle, to try and get into that top tier. And so if you've got teams, county teams in the 100, male county teams that are associated with a 100 team, they are going to receive the private investment that comes with that. And then they're also going to be hosting one of only 8 women's county teams. The gaps grow bigger again, don't they? Because if Sussex want one, for example, Hampshire also want one. The chances are Hampshire are going to get one because they've hosted Southern Vipers for the last 4 years. That then just heightens the gap between Hampshire and Sussex, and that playing field that once was level becomes more and more unlevel.
Which leads neatly on to one of the final quotes in your book, actually, here from Gareth Balch, who is CEO of Two Circles, one of the big marketing agencies that have been working in cricket for a long time. He says, "The biggest challenge is to not be obsessed by the people who've loved cricket all their lives, but instead embrace everyone who loves a bit of cricket. We have to help the people that are in love with its shallowness not be scared of its depth."
Yeah, it's a great quote, that. And really, well, Two Circles were very prominent in the birth of the 100 and how it was marketed and all that type of stuff. And really, that quote pertains to the 100, because the 100 is all about trying to grow the sport and trying to instead of catering to people like me who have loved cricket my whole life, it's trying to cater to people that may never have gone down to a game before, but might think, oh, I'll give this a try. And the thinking was, and I think it's been borne out, was that the 100 would be the vehicle to do that rather than these county institutions that have existed for 100 years and might seem closed off and not necessarily for someone that doesn't love cricket but might want to give it a chance.
Yeah. I mean, just one final question, I suppose. Do you feel that the game, you know, with Richard Gould in charge, do you feel like the game's in good hands?
Yes, I do. I think travelling up and down the country, there is a level of optimism around the Gould-Thompson regime that certainly was not in place for some of their predecessors. They're seen as county men. They've been at the operated at the grassroots and they know how it works. Now, I actually put that to Richard Gould and he said, that's very nice to hear, but I have to be more pragmatic than that. I can't just think about it from a county perspective anymore. So he almost tempered the goodwill towards him. But I think it can only be of benefit to have someone that has operated as a chief exec of two counties, also worked in football. So he's worked in another sport, so he can take learnings from that. I think not everyone would agree with this, but I believe that any changes that are made for the good of the game in its entirety under Richard Gould.
Okay, so that's Ben Bloom and his book, Looking at County Cricket. Are we talking here, Yoz, about, you know, fundamentally, what is county cricket for? Who is it for and what's its purpose?
It is, absolutely. That is the fundamental question. And it depends who you are, where you are, who you play for, who you follow, what the answer to that question is. So some counties pride themselves, like Durham, on obviously performing well and hopefully winning titles, as they have done recently, both in the second division and, of course, the first division previously, but also in producing England players, representing England. So that's one role that, certain counties pride themselves on. And it's interesting here that Ben reveals that of the 92 England Test debutants between 2003 and 2023, only 9 of them out of 92 have made their county championship debut for Leicestershire, Derbyshire, Gloucestershire, Worcestershire or Glamorgan. So Leicestershire and Derbyshire produced 3 England players in the last 20 years, Gloucestershire 2, Worcestershire 1, Glamorgan none. By contrast, 39 of those 92 England Test debutants turned out in the county championship the first time at Surrey, 11, Yorkshire and Durham, 10, and Middlesex, 8. That, of course, is Test cricket. That isn't looking at the one-day game where, you know, there'll be players who've come from those counties, those sort of less productive counties that played in the one-day side. But that's one role for counties. Another role is obviously trying to win titles and trying to perform well. But actually, what you find with the majority of the 69,000 county members who are fully paid up county members across the country is that it's almost that county cricket is a community service. It's a place to go and feel you belong. You know, it's a place where you feel that you've been going to for many years, and there are many county fans who've been going to their county since the 1960s, 1970s. And there's a chap in the book, actually, that he mentions who has been following Derbyshire avidly for 20 years, home and away, and he's a policeman, and he hasn't missed a single game, a single day of a game in that time. So it draws people in, doesn't it? It is a community service. But my point is that even if it is a community service and somewhere that people feel passionately about and don't want it to change, somehow it has to support itself in the end. And it's not going to survive on purely members' subscriptions and a few people through the gate. And, you know, maybe some sponsors. It has to get money from the centre, from ECB, to survive, to get the sort of 6 million that they need to pay the players and pay the running costs of the club. And that money is not going to come from 2,000 members and a few sponsors and a few people through the gate. So there has to be another source of income. And you can't just, the problem that county cricket has is you just can't rely forever on the revenue from the international game, because the revenue from the international game is jeopardised by franchise tournaments around the world, by other sports, by all sorts of other demands on broadcasters, by the competition between broadcasters. So it's difficult for the game. So I feel, and I know this is a personal view and that is not shared by many county fans, I feel that the idea of the 100 is potentially a salvation for the county game, because it's found a potential new source of revenue through the 100, through an enclosed tournament with new teams, which was attractive to broadcasters, and it's got the potential for private income and private investment as well. So I feel, actually, that the 100, though it is much denigrated around the place, is the salvation to that form of the game which we're talking about at the moment, four-day cricket.
How does that feed into all 18 first-class counties? Only some of those counties have got 100 cricket on their grounds, and they actually sort of privately quite like it, don't they, because they get a full houses and they get lots of the add-ons from that, which are, you know, things like hospitality and food and drink and all that sort of thing. You know, it makes them quite a good amount of money, so that's, you know, absolutely valuable. But it doesn't help, you know, some of those other counties you mentioned, actually, that, you know, don't produce England players. I mean, some of the smaller counties, we all know who they are, you know, the likes of Northants and Leicestershire and Gloucestershire and Derbyshire. Of course, Glamorgan, who haven't produced that many England players, you know, do have a franchise on their ground, but, you know, those other teams don't. And I suppose the big anomaly, in a way, I suppose, is Somerset, yeah. Isn't it? I mean, there's a really strong cricket community in Somerset, and it's a very well supported county, and it doesn't have that 100 team. It's a club that is, you know, it's done well. You could sort of argue in recent years it's been punching above its weight. It's been reasonably successful, and there's a vibrancy about cricket when you go to the county ground in Taunton.
No, it's undoubtedly a problem, and Ben, you know, does allude to this, that the problem that the 100 has created, in a way, is that the difference between the haves and the have-nots, the discrepancies, are going to grow, and that is probably true. At the same time, the more money that the 100 generates, the more will percolate down to every county, because there will be a share out, as there is at the moment. Each county gets a certain amount, about 1.3 million from ECB, because of the 100 and the income that has generated, and that's going to increase as you get private investment. But my solution to this is that I feel where I feel counties are losing out, and this is all counties, is they don't get enough money from the centre for the England players that they produce. And that applies to every county. If you produce England players, not only do you lose them because they're not available to play for you anymore, but also you're not getting enough compensation. And that would, in a way, incentivise more counties to produce more England players if you've got more money back from the ECB. And that also applies, I think, to franchises around the world, particularly the IPL. I think the IPL should be paying more money to counties, or more money to the ECB that can be shared amongst all counties for all the players that they buy in. Because at the moment, they're enjoying the fruits of the performances of the likes of Josh Butler and all the other England players that are playing out in India. And the counties are not getting the benefit of that. The players that they've nurtured for many years, they're not getting a return on. So I think that's something that could help balance out the books a bit more. It is going to be a case of some counties, the strong counties, getting stronger, but hopefully the weak counties can at least not get any weaker.
Mm. So you think the IPL will compensate some of the counties for producing players?
I mean, it's an idea. It's not going to be one that they're all going to buy into, but I think at some stage it's going to come to a head, because, you know, the England players are very popular, some of them in particular. And I think that, you know, somehow, I don't know how the negotiations will work here, but there needs to be a conversation about this, because I think it's very unfair at the moment. And, you know, all the Indian franchises are absolutely reaping the benefit of the overseas players, and I think they should cough up more money as a result, probably to, you know, the South Africans and the New Zealanders and the Australians as well.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting. Before we started this podcast, I saw juxtaposition, really. I was actually watching two games, one on my phone and one on the computer. One was the Sussex-Northamptonshire, the denouement to that match, which is actually, you know, it was exciting because Sussex were pushing for victory. And the other one was Chennai Super Kings against Calcutta Knight Riders, packed out at Chepauk, you know, tremendous atmosphere, heaving. It wasn't particularly a good game, actually, because Calcutta Knight Riders didn't get enough runs and Chennai Super Kings knocked them off quite comfortably. But what you couldn't fail to see, I suppose it's an obvious point in a way, is just thought the contrast between the two games, you know, one with that sort of atmosphere, the glitz, the glamour, the spectators, and the other one where, you know, there was barely anyone there at all. And that's, if you like, you see, put those two things together, and it's what you're talking about, isn't it, really? But the players that are playing at Hove today, I'm not saying they will go on and play in the IPL, but that's where they learn their cricket to go on and play in the top tournaments. And Josh Butler was a prime example of that. There aren't actually that many England players doing that well in the IPL. Butler's one who came good at the weekend. He got his first 100 of the season, played magnificently, actually. Coley got 100, then Butler got 100. He actually toe-ended the six that brought him 100 and won his team the game. He toe-ended it over deep in the wicket. It just shows what these bats and what the physiques of these players are like. But there aren't that many. But you're right, in a sense, that is where the players are produced and that's where they end up. And is there compensation for the team that produced them? Well, probably not. But then, you know, you also come back to that thing, who said life's fair? And it is a bit dog-eat-dog out there now, isn't it? It really is. I feel as though we've sort of been having this kind of debate for many, many years. I almost feel as though I've been having it for as long as I followed cricket, actually. You know, with a county cricket, you know, how does it survive? What does it do? What's its purpose?
Listen, there's a passage in A Wisden saying exactly this, exactly what you're saying. With a county cricket, no buzz coming anymore. Is it going to survive, etc.? It's a passage from A Wisden Almanac in 1908. So you're right. Even before your birth, it's a conversation that's been going on.
Yeah, and of course the thing is, cricket has adapted, hasn't it? You think, you know, John Player League, for example, 40 over cricket, then 60 over cricket. Actually, before that, in the 1960s, you know, it is constantly evolving. And then we have the T20 Plus, and now we have the 100. So it has kept on evolving, and the county game has survived. But yeah, what are the economics look like? How important in future is the England team going to be? That's the thing, isn't it? We've got, you know, you look at the state of international cricket, and you've got, you know, three or four strongest sides, or, you know, one very strong side, or two very strong sides, and a couple of decent sides, and then it sort of tails off a little bit. You haven't got that many test match playing teams, you know, and the franchises are desiring those players as well. So you wonder, you know, there is that sort of feeling of not crisis in the game. There'll always be cricket, but it's the form of cricket that we're not sure about, I suppose, in the future. That's the point, isn't it?
Well, in a way, this is a debate which will run and run, and has already run and run, of course. I think it's cricket's strength and its weakness that it's so adaptable. And it's one of the reasons why it's so successful now in the world, because of the adaptability and the bringing in of new formats, but also it causes issues and conflict as well. So, as I say, this debate will run and run. Just a little aside, just to finish, something that has sort of exercised me for a while is how to help a county offset some of its costs and perhaps find new sources of revenue through the streams. So starting on Friday, I'm working on a project with Hampshire to hopefully enhance the quality of their live stream, and with using some remote operated cameras, which we're bringing in for the first time on Friday. You'll be able to see that on the Hampshire stream, fingers crossed, weather permitting as well. And there is potential revenue to be found if you enhance your streams. More on that over the course of the summer. But that's something that I'm trying to work on with Hampshire, and Hampshire have been very engaged with this idea. So we'll keep you posted on that, on this podcast, how that goes, and keep watching as well. And love to hear your feedback, any thoughts you have on how CounterHit could find new sources of revenue. Obviously, you can email us at theanalystpodcast @gmail.com. Don't also forget the excellent Storylines podcast, our sister podcast. You know, Simon, both of them, both Nikki and Melissa, you know, recent winner of the Christopher Martin Jenkins Broadcaster Award. It's an amazing performance, that. Both of them have broken digits this week. One's broken her knuckle and the other one's broken her thumb. So I think their season's going to be slightly interrupted, but maybe that means they can do more podcasts. So the podcast is called Storylines with Melissa Story and Nikki Chowdhury, and the latest episode is out today as well.
So they're not playing those ramp shots they were talking about a couple of pods ago, was it?
I don't know, actually. Listen to the podcast and you'll find out.
Indeed. Okay, that's it for today. So lots of issues, really, to think about.
As usual.
Do we have any solutions? I think that's the thing. Or are we just going to potter on? Are we still going to be having this debate, you know, this discussion in 10, 20, 30 years' time? Well, we might not be in 30 years' time or 20 years' time, but perhaps people still will be, judging by that wisdom of 1908. It's a great game, isn't it? It's just, I suppose it's just a question of how you sell it, put it together, make it work. I mean, I have to say, this is a sort of admission right at the end of this podcast. I didn't, when the season came round, you know, sort of start of last week, I didn't look forward to it, that same anticipation that I do with the football season, which is played in, you know, nice weather, August. You know, you're ready for it. You've had no football for 3 months. Cricket, you look out the window, it's blowing a gale, it's raining, you know, you're still walking on Wimbledon Common in your Wellington boots and it's, you know, mud up to your ankles.
Are you serious that you look forward to a season supporting Bristol City? Are you serious?
I'm an eternal optimist, you see, Oz. That's what it is.
You're not. You're a misery guts. And you only like it when you can wear your shorts. So get your shorts on.
Well, that's what we need.
Maybe the weather will improve.
Exactly. We need some decent weather. That's what we need. And that's what gets you going, isn't it? The weather. And I'm afraid, you know, looking out the windows, it's not been great. So and it has been a disappointing start to the season. You know, there have been some great performances. Harry Brook, 100 off 69 balls. Great performance from Cashy Valley. We must mention him. 200s in the same game for Worcestershire. Comes through the Saka Academy. Fantastic story, that, and worth keeping an eye on. Wickets for Sam Cook and all those runs at Lords. But, you know, generally speaking, the season started with a bit of a whimper rather than a bang, and I think that's it's perhaps the nature of cricket, isn't it, really? It reflects life quite closely. It's not all highs. There are a few lows out there as well.
Yeah, well, there are, but I'm glad you mentioned the Harry Brook 100, because I wonder if he was using one of the refurbished bats by the young 13-year-old boy who set up an Instagram account as a result of his engagement with Harry Brook. We told the story on an earlier podcast that Harry Brook responded to an advert from this kid saying, "I can refurbish your bats." He's refurbished six of Harry's bats, and apparently he's very happy. There are some fit photos on my Instagram account, Cricket Analyst One, of the lad in question refurbishing Harry's bats. And to get your own bat refurbished, he's keen to get some more clients. So look up WLC Bat Refurbs. WLC Bat Refurbs. To get a very nicely restored bat for use this summer. Listen, we've got to go. That's it. By the way, the book that I mentioned at the start, Batting for Time, The Fight to Keep English Cricket Alive by Ben Bloom, is published by Pitch International and available from all retail outlets and, of course, online as well. We'll be back later in the week. I'll be reporting from Hampshire. See you then. Thanks for listening.
Thanks very much for listening. Let that sun shine. Goodbye for now.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah. Oh. Sorry, we were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.